This is Steve Maxer conducting an interview with Mr. Keith Erdman on the 26th of February 2001 at approximately 9:15 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Erdman is in Arizona. Sir, when and where were you born?
May 7th, 1948, Chicago, Illinois.
Okay. And did you grow up in the Chicago area?
No, I think it was about November of 48. My family moved to Michigan, where my father was from.
Mm-hmm. How long did you live there?
All my life.
Okay. What was it like growing up there?
It was interesting. Small town. When I was a real small child, I lived on a farm with my grandparents for a couple of years till my dad got a job, and we were able to get our own place.
Okay.
As it turned out, the first place we rented, the people that rented it to us, the lady ended up being my boss at a grocery store when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. And, you mentioned in the questionnaire that you worked quite a bit as a young person.
Yeah, my parents got divorced when I was like 13.
Okay.
And I was the oldest one of six kids, so I ended up, helping to supply money for food on the table,
mm-hmm.
buy my own clothes for school, etc. I worked as a paper boy. I did odd jobs. I worked at the neighbor's across the street from our house. At that time, the neighbors had horses, and I worked with helped the neighbor out with his horses. I helped him build an addition on his house.
Mm-hmm.
Delivered newspapers, and then I worked in a grocery store. In a couple of summers, I worked in a celery. In the celery fields, mucking the celery plants and doing the celery processing.
Mm-hmm. Was that difficult work?
Well, yeah, that was real difficult work. You're crawling on your hands and knees for 150 feet or 200 feet down this field, and turn around and go back the other way. When you get done with one row, you do another row. So it was kind of painstaking work.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the process there was cutting the ends off the celery and trimming them in the processing area there. And I think the second year I worked there, I ended up working inside that part of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you and your brothers and sisters get along well?
Yeah, I think we got along really well. I was pretty busy, working most
mm-hmm.
of the time, but... Yeah, I got a whole suitcase full of letters I used to get from my youngest brother and my next to my youngest brother when I was in Vietnam. Those might be of interest to you.
Yes, sir, they are. And what was the breakdown of you as children in terms of brothers and sisters, boys and girls?
There were four boys and two girls.
Okay. I would imagine that after the divorce, all of your siblings tried to kick in and help?
Yeah. Yeah, well, my youngest brother was only like a year old
mm-hmm.
When my parents got divorced.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of a hectic part of my life there. I started hanging around with the wrong crowd at school. Got in a little bit of trouble, not real serious trouble. But
mm-hmm.
then I kind of straightened out after that.
Was there anything in particular that you enjoyed about school? Subjects or sports or something?
Yeah, I like government, of all things.
Okay.
Government and cross-country. I ran cross-country for 3 years, I think. And
mm-hmm.
I was on the bowling league for a couple of years. So
and
I did have an opportunity to play some sports, but
mm-hmm.
my work after school and stuff kind of dictated what I was allowed to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead and why don't you go in and talk about how you came to volunteer to go
yeah,
into the
that's
service.
Another story in itself.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was in June the Air Force approached me because I was pretty mechanically inclined. I scored pretty high on that test. And I was all signed up on a 120-day delay program to go into Air Force as a engine mechanic. After basic, I would have been trained in working on jet engines and stuff like that. And at that time, I was living with a buddy of mine, and he was all gung-ho about going into the Marine Corps, and he had the buddy plan and all that stuff. And one night, we stayed up all night watching war movies, of all things, and drinking beer and having a good time. And I think the next day, we went down and signed up for the Marine Corps. So we ended up going into the Marine Corps on the buddy plan. We both went to Parris Island, South Carolina, We both went to Camp Pendleton, mm-hmm. I guess San Diego Recruit Depot is what they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, we went to, he and, there was like four of us that were pretty close. Fred, myself, Brian, and Brian's buddy that he came in on the buddy plan with. And those three guys all went to further training and went to Vietnam within a few months after getting out of all the basic training. And after basic training, I got sent back to Camp Pendleton. 27th Marines, and started doing training and infantry games and war games, they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And I took classes, and I ended up being a weapons instructor. And toward the end, before I went to Vietnam, I was one of the bad guys during the war games. I had like a platoon of guys. And we were the bad guys. I was meritoriously promoted from PFC to Lance Corporal, and then another meritorious promotion to Corporal before I went overseas. And then we went to, I think I volunteered to go overseas in, it would have been November or so of 67. That was after I'd found out my buddy got shot over there, and he got all messed up. At first they said he was killed, and then they found out he was still alive and in a hospital in Japan, and he got all the way back to Great Lakes Naval Hospital before anybody even realized that he was still alive. His dad was notified that he was killed in action and all that stuff.
Mm.
It was pretty... pretty crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I ended up going to Vietnamese language school in, would have been, I think, February of 68. There was a bunch of us that were in advanced training for Vietnam, and during that school, training, they gave us an aptitude test for foreign language, and all the guys that scored relatively high on it got to go to this Vietnamese language school. And myself and Dennis Burke and Paul Covarrubias were the three corporals that were at the school, and I was the head corporal. I had the most time in grade, and so they put me in charge of the school. We went to that crash course for 90 days. And at the end of that 90 days, I was promoted to sergeant. And at that time, I was one of the youngest sergeants in the Marine Corps. When I went to Vietnam, I was the youngest sergeant in the 3rd Marine Division over in Vietnam.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and go a little bit deeper into some of your training.
What's that?
Let's go ahead and go a little bit deeper into some of your training. In particular, and here you go, graduate from high school, get drunk one night, watch some war movies, and end up in the Marine Corps. What were you? What were your expectations about boot camp? And did they meet or exceed those expectations?
Well, boot camp we knew was going to be a bugger. You know, we figured it was going to be hell because we've seen all the movies and they always put a little bit about basic training in a lot of those movies. And we had a friend of ours that graduated from high school before. Well, he graduated with us, and he went into Marine Corps in June. So when he got out of the boot camp, he would send us gum in the mail, knowing that we'd be punished for getting this gum in the mail. We spent a lot of time doing push-ups.
Okay.
I still owe him for that. I've never collected, but mm-hmm. I still owe him for that.
What was the most challenging part of boot camp for you?
The most challenging part, I think, was keeping the guys all together. I don't know. I think maybe because I was a young adult, you know, having six or five brothers and sisters below me and being head of the family, so to speak, at a young age, gave me kind of an aptitude for keeping things under control. And so I think that was probably the most challenging thing, is keeping these guys all together, because there was a lot of jabbing and infighting and stuff like that, where guys were giving each other a lot of hassle. But the DIs were, you know, those guys were sharp. I mean, they seemed to be like psychiatrists, and but they knew what the job they had to do was to make it so we'd survive. And there was a few guys that didn't make it. I mean, the guys that just weren't strong enough and mm-hmm. ended up going back. And some, I'm sure, got mustered out. We had one guy in our company that I think it was his third attempt to make it through basic training.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall if he made it through with us or not. I'd have to get out my my book that I don't have with me and look in there and see if his name is in there. But yeah, it was a pretty harrowing experience. A lot of physical and mental work, and they were always yelling at you for this and that. And there were days when you were wondering if you'd be able to wake up in the morning because you were so sore and stiff. And I was a non-smoker, but I started smoking just because those were the only guys that got breaks. If you got them, light them up.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of guys started smoking just because they got a break
mm-hmm.
from doing everything. I remember at night, they'd take a... we had like a stove in the middle of our Quonset hut, and the guys would huddle around underneath this blanket smoking cigarettes at night, and then poofing the smoke into the stove and letting it go up the pipe and outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember being on the top bunk by the window that faced the DI's hut and watching to see if they came out. And if they came out, I'd signal the guys that were smoking and they'd quit for a while, not blow any smoke out the stack. But I'm sure them DIs sat in there with their binoculars or whatever and just kind of laughed at what was going on out there. I'm sure, you know, with thousands and thousands of people they put through there, that they knew everything that went on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What were there any experiences or anything that stands out in particular from boot camp for you?
Well, there's several things that happened. We were at... I think it was Camp Peterson was a gunnery range at that time,
mm-hmm.
where you shot your rifles for long distances, like 1,000 yards. And that's where they checked for people for, like, recon and sniper school and stuff like that. And I had a rifle that wouldn't shoot. I mean, I was a good shot because I grew up hunting and fishing, and I was a really good shot, and I couldn't hit the target. And they kept coming over and kicking on me and smacking at me and yelling at me, and sir, it's the rifle. It's a rifle. So finally this one guy came over and he said he was a Olympic shooting champion. He was like a staff sergeant. He came over there and shot my rifle and missed the target and said, yep, rifle's bad. Send him to the armory and get another one. So they sent me to the armory and I got another rifle and I came back and apparently while I was gone to the armory, one of the recruits that was getting picked on really bad shot one of the instructors.
Wow.
And so that was pretty mortifying that somebody would do something like that. Wonder, you know, what makes people tick, and that was not good.
Now, you were firing M14s?
Yeah, right. That would have been the M14 we were firing.
What happened to the instructor?
I don't remember. I can't remember if he died or if he was just wounded. That all happened while I was gone to the armory.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came back is when I found out about it.
My goodness. And what happened to the recruit?
He was hauled off. The MPs came and got him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what happened to him either. You know, when you're in basic training, you're not privy to that type of information.
Yeah, I didn't know if it filtered down.
Yeah.
Wow.
They kind of keep that. You know, I'm sure the instructors knew what happened, but you know they're not going to say anything.
No.
Then we were at hand grenade training one time, and one of the instructors was showing us what not to do and accidentally let the spoon fly on what they call a Willie Peter grenade that was white phosphorus, and the thing exploded right in his hand, and he just disintegrated. I mean, he virtually disappeared before our eyes.
My goodness.
And we had to go around and search for body parts. And the only thing we found was the palm of one hand, I mean just the skin part, palm of one hand, and a couple other fragments of body.
Oh, goodness.
I mean, white phosphorus just ate this guy right up.
Mm-hmm.
We found pieces of his uniform and stuff like that, but for as far as his physical body, the biggest thing we found was like part of the palm of one of his hands.
How far away from you, the trainees, the recruits, how far away was he from you when that happened?
Oh, we were probably 50, 80 feet away, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when it went off, it went off right, you know, into his body, and
goodness.
He pretty much shielded anybody else around there
mm-hmm.
from it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was... It was something else, boy. Whew.
Any recruits drop out after something like that, or after the incident where the DI was shot?
Not that I recall.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, back when we were in school, I mean, you didn't just drop out if you didn't make it through mm-hmm. to their satisfaction. You went to what they call the motivation platoon
mm-hmm.
and receive further instruction there, and then when they thought you were ready, then they'd put you with another recruit school and start you over again.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's not, I guess today they can get out just by saying they quit, mm-hmm. but that's probably not quite that easy, but you know, with something similar to that.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody seem to have trouble dealing with it psychologically? It's a rather traumatic event.
Not that I could tell. From my point of view, I mean, everybody was pretty shocked, you know, when the guy gets, you know, wasted.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a couple guys that had trouble in when we were throwing hand grenades. That kind of goofed up and dropped the pin inside the pit. And that. They didn't get the hand grenade very far apart, and there was a big explosion really close by.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of our training was live fire training. I mean, when you see the advertisement where they crawl in underneath the barbed wire and they're shooting,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that was live ammunition that they shot.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the what you call ground effects, so they had bombs going off in different spots around you, so it'd be just like a firefight. So all the training that you got was, I guess, so you wouldn't be surprised. That loud noises wouldn't surprise you, or sudden movements wouldn't surprise you. I mean, you went through all the basic war training during basic training in ITR, is what they called infantry training regiment.
Mm-hmm.
That was when you did even more stuff, and then you went to the guys that went right to Vietnam after basic training went to a staging battalion, and they received jungle training for 4 weeks. And they showed them booby traps and all that stuff. But I think the guys like myself that stayed in country longer, in the U.S. longer, and got to be with an infantry fighting unit and played the war games for, you know, I played war games for almost a year and a half. And during that part of that time, I was an instructor. Part of that time, I was a bad guy. And so you learned a lot of stuff because you pulled stuff on the guys. You know,
mm-hmm.
our goal as bad guys was to go get the general out of his tent at night without the good guys knowing we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And we were pretty darn successful.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, it got to the point where the general got mad and said, okay, I'm getting tired of being rousted out of my sleep. I'll put my two stars on the bedpost there, and you take those. And if I wake up in the morning and they're gone, then I know my guys failed.
Mm-hmm.
So the next operation we had, that's what we had to do. We had to sneak in there and steal his stars and then leave,
mm-hmm.
instead of taking him out. It was hard, and it was more difficult taking him out because you had to gag him so he didn't yell. And,
right.
And but it was pretty embarrassing, I think. He didn't like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I forgot to ask a couple of questions about you going in terms of your family's perceptions. You know, what did your mom think when you went home and told her, hey, Mom, I just signed up for the Marine Corps?
I really don't recall that,
okay.
You know, that part
mm-hmm.
that much. I know my brothers and sisters were kind of disappointed, but they kind of understood. My
mm-hmm.
dad was a World War II veteran.
Okay.
And I basically told him, I'm doing it, so hopefully you won't ever have to.
Mm.
I remember that part,
mm-hmm.
and thank God none of them ever had to.
Mm-hmm. Now, and did you have much contact with your dad over the years?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, the older I got, the closer we got.
Okay. And did you tell him when you enlisted?
Oh yeah, yeah.
What did he think?
He was worried.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was worried.
Yeah, so Vietnam War was in full swing at this point.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I graduated from high school in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
And I got in country just in time for the Tet Offensive in 1968.
Well, what did you think, or what did you know about what was happening in Vietnam when you went to enlist?
Well, you know, everything you read in the paper, I guess when you got over there, you realized that it was all a bunch of crap. I mean, because the newspapers were only printing what they were told to print, and that really wasn't what was going on over there. I mean, the American people didn't have a clue to all the stuff that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, for whatever reason, you know, I'm sure the government, you know, had their reasons for keeping everything secret and not letting things out, but war is war, and you got to do things that are not good. I mean, nobody likes killing people, but if they're going to kill you, you'd rather kill them so they don't get you, and you can go on.
Mm-hmm.
But my grandmother used to send me the local newspaper, and we'd laugh. When I was over there, we'd laugh at what the newspaper printed, what was going on, and, you know, what was actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
I've got some tapes that I sent my dad when I was over there, but I don't know if they're even able to get anything off from them anymore because they're so old.
Mm-hmm. Well, tapes are actually pretty stable medium.
Are they?
Yes, sir.
I've kept them sealed up in... they're real small tape, though. They're those I called them a $10 tape recorder back in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
It was real small. I think the reels were like 2 inches.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got several of those that I saved that my dad and I used to talk back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on those tapes.
Mm-hmm.
And I've often thought about taking them to an audio place to see if they could transfer that information onto something good, but I've never gotten around to it.
Well, we have, we can talk about this more later, but we have that capability if you're interested.
Oh, cool. So. Yeah, I'd be very interested.
Okay. Now, back to boot camp real quick.
Okay.
You mentioned there's one incident. Somebody got into an altercation, apparently, with a DI.
Uh-huh.
Would you talk about that briefly?
Which one?
A guy named Dewberry.
Oh, Newberry. Yeah, or Dewberry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't remember if it was Dewberry or Newberry. Yeah, he was. We were at the rifle range then at Camp Peterson, and he was mouthing off, and he said something smart back to the DI, and he was one of our guys that had been to the motivation platoon like 2 times.
Mm-hmm.
And then came into our unit, and the DI told him to face the wall, or kiss the wall, he said. Yeah, Newberry just turned around and faced the wall, and didn't put his face right up tight against it, and the DI came by and hit him on the back of the head, and he was just far enough away from the wall that when he hit him like that, it broke his nose and broke a couple of his front teeth.
Mm-hmm.
So he was kind of a bloody mess, and I said, man, I said, that Newberry guy, he just don't listen.
And did he just get fixed up and brought back to the to your platoon, or?
Yeah, it seems like he got fixed up and came back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the guy that I don't know if he graduated with us or
okay.
if he went back to Motivation Platoon again.
Yeah.
Because when you go to the rifle range, you're toward the end of your time in basic training.
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't recall if he went back to Motivation Platoon or if because that happened to him, they let him graduate and sent him on mm-hmm. to get him out of their hair and
mm-hmm.
hopefully not have any heart feelings.
Mm-hmm. Was there much occasion in addition to that for there to be physical contact between DIs and recruits?
Not really. There was a lot of, like, hand-to-hand combat with the bungee pogo sticks,
mm-hmm.
with the padded ends on the pogo sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very adamant about really beating on people with those pogo sticks, you know, just so they knew that, you know, even though they're cushioned, they'll hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember getting knocked a little silly one time. 'Cause I was... kind of, I would do different things, and so I wouldn't get hit. You
mm-hmm.
know, I'd roll on the ground, and because the only thing that you had to do was kill the other guy, and if you jabbed him in the stomach with your stick, you killed him.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd just roll over on the ground and stick my stick up in his belly, and that big fat end, I mean, that thing had to be 8-10 inches around, and that would be a kill. Therefore, I wouldn't get hit.
Mm-hmm.
He sent a couple of guys out there after me and says, hit him. Oh, boy, one of them got me, too. Holy mackerel. I mean, I saw stars.
Wow.
I mean, we had helmets on and everything, but I think he wound up like a baseball bat and hit me because he just knocked me for a loop.
Wow.
I didn't see it coming.
Mm-hmm. And the DIs that were training you, were most of them Vietnam veterans?
I would say all of them were.
Did they talk a lot about what they experienced in Vietnam and training?
Sometimes. Not in the correlation like a guy speaking to, like me talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they would say, that'll kill you over there, that'll kill you over there.
Right.
You know, so they really didn't talk about their experiences or what they experienced. They just would refer back to Vietnam as if when you made a mistake, that had cost you your life.
Mm-hmm. Were there any particular lessons that you remember? And they said, you know, this will save your life or this could kill you in Vietnam?
Oh, boy. Not really.
Okay.
I just, a lot of that's hard to remember.
Mm-hmm.
You're bringing up some...
Oh, yeah.
A lot of old stuff here that I haven't thought about for a long, long time.
Yes, sir. Well, was there ever anything that you received in training where they said, you know, something like, you know, we've got to train you on this because it's part of the training doctrine, but the bottom line is this is irrelevant for Vietnam or this doesn't matter for Vietnam or something?
Oh, yeah,
like.
Yeah. Yeah, they did do that, yeah. There was a couple of things, like in weapons training, because we didn't get M16s until just before we got out of ITR. I mean, we trained with the M1.
Mm-hmm.
And the M14, and the I can't even remember the name of it now. It was a big rifle that had a tripod on the end of it. So it was a BAR, is what it was. And something assault rifle, BAR. But it was bigger than the M14, and it had legs on the end of the barrel. So it was a pretty heavy weapon. And it shot a lot of rounds, but it wasn't a machine gun. And they said, you guys will probably never see any of these weapons. And then I went into weapons training. I didn't get the weapons training until I think I was in... I think I was with the 27th Marines when I went to weapons training school. And then I taught weapons during the time that I was doing the war games and stuff like that. But basic training, I don't think we saw M16 until like toward the end of infantry training school when we were up at Camp Pendleton. But we were out of basic training.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The basic training was what we did in San Diego at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot. And then you went to Infantry Training Regiment for more advanced training. And at that time is when we got the M16s. And I'm trying to remember, I think it was out of basic training that I was selected to go to... they were going to send me to school to be a seagoing Marine. That'd be a Marine that was on a ship, and you'd be like an MP, a guard at or an aide to the commander of the ship or whatever. And I asked permission to refuse that. Because all my buddies went to infantry school. So they changed my orders from going to that other training. Then I went back to being in the infantry. And during ITR, I was in charge of the supplies. That everybody had a duty in infantry training regiment, extra duty other than keeping care of your hut and stuff like that. And they put me in charge of the supply room. And I handed out toilet paper, soap, toothbrushes, toothpaste, and stuff like that. And after we got out of ITR, I was promoted to PFC upon graduating from ITR. There was a few guys in our company that got promoted to PFC right out of boot camp. And then a few more of us got promoted to PFC out of infantry training regiment. And then after infantry training regiment, then my buddies and I got split up. They went to Camp Lejeune, South Carolina, and I went back out to Camp Pendleton. And that's where I joined up with the 27th Marines.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you received the first time you received the M16 and fired it, what did you think of it?
Oh, I thought it was pretty cool. It was a pretty simple weapon, lightweight. Not near as heavy as that M14. Man, that thing weighed a ton. It weighed a ton.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed us, you know, that it would last. It would fire better under the conditions over Vietnam, which were, they got a lot of rain over there and a lot of mud and stuff like that. So, but one of the things they reiterated to us a lot was keeping your weapon clean.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you get a moment, clean your weapon, because that's your lifeline.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true. I mean, I was in a couple of firefights where my weapon misfired. And I can only attribute it to the fact that I think I set my weapon down to help somebody that was wounded. Several of us put our weapons down, and I didn't get my weapon back. I got somebody else's weapon. Because I was a fanatic, you know, being a weapons instructor, I was a fanatic about keeping my weapon clean. And
mm-hmm.
never had any trouble up to that point on mm-hmm. that day that a doggone thing jammed, I threw it away and found another one that somebody else that got medevaced out. We always kept their guns, so because we, in case we had a misfire or one that didn't work, so that we'd have an extra weapon for that person.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say you threw that one down, it wasn't like left. It was just, you just put it down.
I just put it down and grabbed another one.
And
yeah, when we left, we took everything with us. I mean, when we finally got off that hill, we took all the extra guns and stuff with us.
This is, we're a bit further ahead than I want to be,
yep,
but I want to
okay.
ask this question while we're there. Would you guys keep track of who had what weapons by serial number? That is, while you were in Vietnam?
When I was in Vietnam, I don't believe so.
Okay.
No, I don't believe so, because I know a lot of guys, after that one big firefight we were in, had different weapons what they came with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But they did have serial numbers on them.
I think so, but I really don't recall.
Okay.
They were so mass produced that
yeah.
I'm not sure that they it seems like all gun makers put serial numbers on their weapons.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that only makes sense to me, but I don't recall that each specific weapon had one.
Okay. Now real quick, back to your training, before you went to Vietnam, you mentioned that, of course, you spent quite a bit of time, basically, I guess it was a year, back here in the United States before you went to Vietnam.
Right.
And during that time period, you went through your boot camp in ITR, you went through, and you also went through some language training.
Right.
Why don't you go ahead and describe the language training and how effective or ineffective it was?
Well, the Vietnamese training school was at the Presidio of Monterey in California, Northern California. It's located up by Fort Ord. And they taught a lot of different languages there. I guess every language that was in the world they taught there and had instructors from those countries there. We had Vietnamese instructors. So I guess that would be my first contact with a Vietnamese person was at this Vietnamese language school. They took teachers from Vietnam and brought them over to the U.S. here to teach us. It was 8 hours a day with the teacher, and then 3 hours every night with homework. And you'd listen to these tapes. And actually, we found out, and I think, I'm not sure if our school is one of the guinea pigs for this or if they'd done it before, but if you listen to the tape while you're sleeping at night, you retain a lot more of the information. So it was nice going to the class during the day and speaking and listening and talking and trying to understand. But then when you went home at night and listened to the videotape and followed your lesson plan or book through, then you, when you went to sleep at night, you put on these headphones and listened to all that stuff all over again. And it was pretty intense training from that standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
That for 90 days, this is all you had. We had weekends where we could do things, but we didn't really have any time after class to go out into town or anything like that.
Okay. And did you find that when you got to Vietnam, this training was useful?
Well, it was beneficial for me because after I'd been in Vietnam for, I think, 7 months, 6 months, something like that, close to seven, I was requested by the commanding general of the 3rd Marine Division to meet with him, and they reassigned me to a Army MACV unit as an advisor to the Vietnamese police field forces in Quang Tri province. So my Vietnam language training helped me in that sort of way, but the only problem was in Quang Tri province they spoke a different dialect. We were all trained in the Saigon dialect, which was the area way south,
mm-hmm.
in South Vietnam. So I could understand bits and pieces, but the words weren't exactly the same, so I had to have an interpreter, because I was the only American there working with these Vietnamese police people.
Okay. And is there anything else that you want to talk about with regard to your training or your time with the 27th Marines before going to Vietnam?
Well, I think that time that I spent in California there doing that training helped my survivability when I was over in Vietnam. I think I had a better survival concept, especially when I had the ability to be one of the bad guys and go disrupt the general's sleep. It gave you a different perspective than just being the guy standing around there on guard watching for the bad guy. So I think my survivability was enhanced by having this all this extra training, more so than the guys that got sent right over,
mm-hmm.
right out of basic training.
Mm-hmm. So by the time you you received orders that you were going to Vietnam, did you feel like you were as prepared as you could be?
Yes. Uh-huh.
When you did find yourself in Vietnam, and after spending a certain amount of time there, did you ever think back and say, boy, I wish they would have talked about this or that or the other thing in training, or focused more on certain things in training?
No, I think I only wish that I probably would have went out on a ship.
Okay. All right. So what did you think when you received your orders that you were going to Vietnam?
Well, I was happy because I volunteered to go to Vietnam because
mm-hmm.
my buddy had been shot. And
mm-hmm.
I was going over there to settle a score and
mm-hmm.
had all these rah-rah,
mm-hmm.
gung-ho plans. And so that part of it wasn't bothering me.
Mm-hmm. And at this point, you were a sergeant in 5.
Right.
And so more than likely, you would be either a team leader, more likely actually a squad leader.
Right.
Yeah,
I was a squad leader to start with, and then right guide and platoon leader, depending on who got shot
mm-hmm.
on any specific operation.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of determined where you were on the ladder.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe your trip over.
That trip over.
Yeah.
Let's see. We hopped on an airplane in I think we got on the plane in You know, I can't even remember where I got on a plane at.
Okay.
But I know we went to Seattle, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped there and picked up some guys. Then we went to Anchorage, Alaska. Then we went to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went to Okinawa. And then we went to Vietnam from Okinawa.
Do you remember where in Vietnam you arrived?
I arrived in Dong Ha. I think it was Dong Ha. No, Dong Ha was... No, that's wrong. Da Nang.
Okay.
Da Nang is where I came in at.
Do you remember... What were your first impressions when you got off that plane?
I says, the first thing I looked around, I says, holy smokes, this is big. That Da Nang airstrip and the base around there was really huge.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a little while to get to where I was going to get my orders and get sent out in the field. I took some pictures of Da Nang, the airstrip there. I think when I went on... either when I was going home or when I went out, when I went to Australia for R&R.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a couple of Polaroid shots of the airfield there.
Okay.
I probably got about 40 or 50 pictures. I was a real camera nut, and I carried a Brownie little box camera.
Mm-hmm.
And but most of my film never came back to me. So somebody's got a lot of good footage.
Oh, no.
Because we were in the shit a lot, and I took a lot of pictures. I bet you I took a roll a week.
Wow.
And I never got those back, and I kept saving my film, and we'd send them out on the chopper and in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we were out for long operations, because sometimes we were gone 45 days a crack, and when the chopper would come in, bring us more food or whatever, they'd take the mail out and they'd bring us mail in. But I never saw any of those pictures that I sent out on the chopper in the mailbag.
Mm-hmm.
They all went to some photo studio in Louisiana. Anyway, where was I before I got lost here?
Oh, well, you're just talking about your first impressions.
Oh yeah.
Of arriving in country.
Well, when I when I finally got up to Dong Ha, and that was probably a 50-mile trip in the back of a deuce and a quarter. And I'm trying to remember if we flew up to Quang Tri. I think we might have flown from... That part's kind of sketchy, too. I don't know if we flew from Quang... or from Da Nang to Quang Tri, or if we took we rode in the back of a truck. I don't recall that part. All I remember is getting to Dong Ha, to the base.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I think, three of us that reported for duty, myself and two other guys. I don't remember the two other guys' names.
Mm-hmm.
And there was incoming. And me and one of the guys ran out the back door with the guys that were already in there, you know, the guys that had been in country for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And the one guy that turned around and ran back out the front door took a direct hit.
Mm.
So we never saw him again, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Just they went around and picked up pieces of that guy.
Mm.
But I guess that was quite a shock to the system when they said, well, that guy's trip's over. So that was kind of a hairy deal and a real eye opener.
Mm-hmm.
Here today, gone tomorrow type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And being a sergeant, you know, I was higher up in rank than all the guys that were in the office there. But I was a kind of a smart guy, and I listened to what people have to say of lesser rank just because they've been there longer. And they had the experience where I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it worked out pretty good, too, because when I got out to my company, which was on the road to Cantien, they were guarding a bridge. I met the company commander, and then I became a squad leader first, and so I took over a squad from a corporal that had about 3 or 4 months left to do before he went home. And I just told him, I says, you've been here for 8 months. The squad's still yours. I'll sit back and pay attention, and when I feel ready, I'll take over.
Mm-hmm.
So for about 2 or 3 weeks, I just, you know, I played the role of a team leader, and he stayed the squad leader, and I just paid attention.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go on night patrol and stuff like that. After a while, I felt comfortable, and so then I took over the squad. And the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. Well, you when did you arrive in country?
I think it was April 6th of 1968.
Okay. And the exact unit that you were assigned to, this was C Company 1st to the 4th?
Yep. Charlie Company 1-4, 3rd Marine Division.
3rd MARDIV. And what was the, you know, what kind of briefing or briefings did you receive when you arrived at the unit?
I don't remember receiving much of a briefing other than the fact that the captain told me that this is where we're at today, we don't know where we'll be tomorrow, and right now we're guarding this bridge over this little river here. And it's the only way that they can get supplies to Cantien and some army base that was up that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was our job, was to keep that bridge safe. So we would do patrols way out around at night to keep the Vietnamese away so they couldn't get their mortars in close enough to do any damage.
Okay.
And that was basically from we were there from the 6th of April. Yeah, I mean, I got in country, and I went from Da Nang to Dong Ha to out there all in the same day.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't waste any time. So I must have flown from Da Nang to Quang Tri. Mm-hmm. And then taking a truck or a jeep or something from Quang Tri landing field to Dong Ha.
Mm-hmm.
excuse me.
Mm-hmm. You need to take a break for a second?
No, I'm fine now.
Okay. Did you, your first impressions of the unit, what did you think?
I says, well, this is where I'm going to live for a while. I'm looking at these guys, and they're all living in the ground, and
mm-hmm.
dirt all over the place. And I says, well, I guess.
What kind of base camp area was it?
It was kind of rocky and sandy. We had a perimeter set up around this bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice because you could take a bath every day because you had that water right there.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the guys, you know, basically stayed fairly clean, and you could wash your clothes and stuff like that, so you'd have clean clothes to wear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was just I think every 4 nights you went out on night patrol, because there was a company there. Let's see. 3 squads to a platoon. 4 platoons to a company. So about once a week you went out on patrol, on night patrol. And you never really followed the time you went out, you'd deviate so that if they were watching you, they wouldn't be able to ambush you in any one specific place at any specific time. The captain was very astute about things like that. He dictated pretty much, you know, daily variances from your norm. You know, one day they'd walk around the compound one way, and the next day they'd walk around the area a different way, and the third day they'd walk even a different way. Might go in basically the same direction, but they'd start at a different point. One day, if you took a clock and made a circle around your complex there and took a clock, one day you'd leave at 10 o'clock and go out, and then you'd shift to the south. And the next day you might go out, shift to the north, and then swing around and shift back to the south partway through your patrol. And the next night they'd go to the north and go all the way around. And they'd come in at a different point than they went out at. So they were very good about that type of thing. It was amazing at night how much light there was over there because of the stars and the moon. During the monsoon season, though, that was a totally different story. You could be out there in the monsoons and you couldn't see the guy a foot in front of you. It rained so hard, and it was just black.
Now, what about Vietnamese civilians? Did you have a lot of contact with them in that area?
No contact with them in that specific area that we were at. It was probably, I really didn't have any contact with the civilians until I went to work as an advisor to the Vietnamese police.
Okay. Well, how large was the contingent of Marines there guarding that bridge?
There was just a company there.
Okay.
And then we had mortars, 81 mortars and, let's see, 81 mortars and, what was the other size? 60 mortars, I guess it was. So we had two mortar platoons with us, or squads, whatever, I don't recall what they were referred to as.
Okay.
Mortar teams, maybe. Be, I think, four guys to each one of those, and they'd have a couple of teams of 81s and a couple of teams of 60s.
And what was morale like when you were
Yeah, morale was pretty good because we didn't get shot at very much. The Vietnamese apparently didn't care about that bridge that much, so they didn't bother us too much there. Once in a while, just to let us know that they were there, they'd send in some mortar fire. And that was pretty interesting because it was like the second day I was there that we got mortar fire. And I got a scrape on the back of my hand diving into my bunker. And they wanted to give me a Purple Heart for that. I said, nah, I don't think so. I'll wait for something more important. But yeah, it seemed like every time they got new guys, or at least I guess that's what the guys said, every time they got new guys, that they'd give them a couple days to get used to things, and then they'd drop a couple of mortar shells in us just to let us know that they were still out there. That was kind of interesting. And then, I think it was in May sometime, Khon Tien was getting hit pretty hard. That was toward the end of the Tet Offensive. And they took us and they left just a platoon behind. It took us all up to Khon Tien to help reinforce those guys. And that was pretty hairy because, I mean, they were getting shelled like every hour on the hour, and you didn't dare stick your head out at all. We were there for probably 2 or 3 days, and then we went back to that back to that bridge.
Mm-hmm. When you were in Kantian, what did you? What else did you do besides take cover when they were showing?
Shoot at the bad guys when you saw them, but okay. You didn't see them that much.
Okay. And when you left, was the shelling still going on, or had it pretty much stopped?
No, it pretty much stopped. They figured they must have moved on to another area, or we were just maybe it was a ploy to get us away from that other bridge. They didn't know for sure. But we went back to the other bridge, and nothing happened for a while until we left there, I think, like the 5th of June or 4th of June. And as we were driving away in the trucks, we could see the shells coming in to greet the new guys, and I guess they really got hit hard.
Wow. Now, were these primarily mortars or rockets as well, and some artillery?
Yeah, they were, I would say, mortars and rockets.
Okay.
I don't think they had much artillery up in that area there. I got to take a break just for a second.
Okay, let me go ahead and call you back. I got to take a break, too. I'll call you back in about 10 minutes.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Uh-huh. Well, why don't you go ahead and, if you would, describe your first patrol, your first time out.
First time out. Ooh, scared.
Mm-hmm.
Nervous as heck. It was interesting, though, because I was completely amazed at how well you could see at night. That was even before they had the what they call the starlight scope,
mm-hmm.
Night vision.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys used to talk about going out on night patrol, getting your eyes adjusted to the night. And I was just amazed at how well you could see. And what you when your sight ended, then your sense of hearing took over. Your sense of smell. So when you got into situations where you couldn't see very well, it seemed like your other senses kind of took over for you. They were heightened. And every little bug and every creature that was out there at night, you could seem like you could hear it. And then when there was a loud noise, that would startle you. You'd stop and get down and look, thinking maybe it could be a Vietnamese patrol or something out there also. And I know the first patrol I went on seemed like it never would end. And then all of a sudden we were back at the camp, safe.
Did you make contact that night?
No. Never made contact any night we were out.
Wow.
It was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Just amazing.
What kind of briefing or operations order or whatever would you receive prior to a patrol?
Well, basically, when I got there, I was told what we were doing. We were guarding this thing, and we went on nightly patrols, but we didn't, your squad wouldn't go out every night. And now that I'm thinking about it, it seems that we sent out two patrols every night because we were on two sides of a river.
Mm-hmm.
So one would go out and cover one side of the river, and we'd go out and cover the other side of the river,
mm-hmm.
because you couldn't go across the river.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no bridges around anywhere except for that bridge that we were sitting on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall what the name of the river was. I have a map back home that's got that river on it, but I did manage to save my map of the Vietnam where I was at anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got that at home.
And did you What kind of traffic went across that bridge on a regular basis?
Just military vehicles. One time we had some tanks went up there and went up to Kantian, and other times we had trucks that went up carrying supplies and personnel.
Mm-hmm. And who built the bridge, do you know?
It was a Vietnamese-built bridge. Mm-hmm. Been there for years.
Okay.
Lubbock.
Now, I'm sorry?
I was talking to my wife.
Oh. So for the time that you were there at that bridge and you'd go on those night patrols, you never actually, you never made contact on patrol. You only had contact in the form of artillery fire or mortar fire or rocket fire.
Right, okay. Yep. The one thing about the Vietnamese, they were piss poor shots.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't hit the broadside of a barn if they were in it.
Now, did your unit, and it, were you ever privy to briefings, intelligence briefings, talking about suspected enemy units in the area, you know, the size, composition, stuff like that of the enemy?
Not until I went to work as an advisor to the Vietnamese police. Then I met weekly with the commanding general of the 3rd Marine Division.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to talk about with regard to your time there with the bridge?
No, that was pretty uneventful.
Mm-hmm.
Other than our trip to Kantian.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and discuss your transition from being in a regular Marine infantry unit to going and working as an advisor for the Vietnamese police. Now, how did those orders come down, and how do you think you got chosen?
Well, I was told I got chosen because I was the youngest sergeant in the 3rd Marine Division, and I had been put up for a Bronze Star, and I had a Purple Heart, and and I knew Vietnamese, although it wasn't the right dialect for that area, but mm-hmm. that was all part of being chosen.
Mm-hmm.
I know it took them 3 days to find us from where we were at. There was a lot of things that went on over there that, you know, the captain would say, go do this, go do that, and you'd wonder, you know. We had maps, and we knew where we were.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent a lot of time in Laos on the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Mm-hmm.
We'd send out what we called seven-man killer teams to ambush the VC and the North Vietnamese when they were coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, mm-hmm. try to blow up their gasoline tankers and their food supply trucks. But we were never in Laos, mm-hmm. and we were never in Cambodia, but we were there.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of the thing is really, you know, that was kind of surprising that all that went on and nobody'd fess up to it.
Now, is this when you were with the unit at the bridge, or?
Yeah. When I went from the unit, we were in quite a bit of combat after that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
We were at a place called LZ Loon where we lost over half of our guys. The company got split up. The captain and two platoons went over on one hill, and
mm-hmm.
My platoon and a mortar unit went over on another hill. And we didn't find out till later that we were right in the middle of a North Vietnamese regular encampment.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in a firefight on June 6th, we were in a firefight for over 13 hours.
Hmm. So, and this is
unbeknownst to us, mm-hmm. the captain and his guys got out of there because they were concentrated. Apparently, when we went over on our hill, we were in the thick of things,
mm-hmm.
and when they went over on their hill, they were on the edge of things.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to get safely choppered out, where the choppers couldn't come in and get us because it was too hot. too much fighting going on. When we were at that LZ Loon, they had the next day after we got there, they started popping guys right out of their foxholes with the mortar fire. So they'd been plotting.
Mm-hmm.
We relieved another company. I think Bravo Company was in there before us, and we relieved Bravo Company, and the Gooks must have come in and plotted all the bunkers while Bravo Company was there, because the next day after we got there, they just let us have it.
Mm.
So we split apart, and I think the company commander, after we got back, one of us that survived got back, talked to him, and he said, yeah, they got out of there before noon that day, and we didn't get out of there until 7:30 at night.
Mm.
So we were pretty lucky. I mean, I was down to one magazine of ammunition, and my machine gunner had 100 rounds of ammunition left. Some of the guys were completely out of ammo. The 60 mortars and 81 mortars, they were out of ammo. All they had was their M16s. So we were a pretty sorry lot. When we finally got out of there, and for 3 days we were known as the Lost Platoon, because when we finally got choppers in there to take us out of there, they took us to Quezon, and they had taken the rest of the company back to Vandergrift Combat Base. So for 3 days, we didn't know if those guys were alive, and they didn't know if we were alive.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept communicating. There was myself and another sergeant. We were the only two sergeants that were there. Our platoon leader and our corpsman and machine gun guy and a couple other guys all got killed early in the morning.
Mm.
And the rest of the guys all got medevaced out during the day when we could get choppers in.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of guys died waiting to get choppers, medevac choppers in there, because the fighting was so heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time, actually twice, we had to call in napalm because there were just so many of them. Looked like ants on a hill coming up after us, and we knew there was no way if they got up there we'd be able to hold them all off, because there were just too many of them.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to call in napalm strikes. Now that stuff's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. I mean, you can see thousands of people down below you on a hill coming up like little bugs, and the next second, nothing but black ash, dark,
mm-hmm.
no movement whatsoever. And, let's see,
what area was that operation with the two hills?
LZ Loon would have been south and west of Quezon, and south and east of Vandergrift.
Mm-hmm. How much more time did you spend with the unit before you went and worked with the Vietnamese police?
Oh, I was there. I was with that unit from April until December.
Okay. So quite a bit longer.
I was out in the bush quite a bit.
Yeah, quite a bit longer.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so you left the bridge, and where did you go from there?
We went to that LZ Loon, the one I just talked about.
Okay, that's for the two hills.
Yeah.
What units, what enemy units, or what type of enemy was it? Was it Viet Cong, Pavan, do you know?
No, they were North Vietnamese regulars,
uh-huh.
but they were all Chinese, every one of them. They were all like 6 foot, 6 foot two, 6 foot four, big guys. They all had brand new Russian helmets and flak jackets and AK-47s. I mean, brand new equipment.
Mm-hmm. Did you capture anybody?
No. No live guys, anyway.
But you took some kills?
Well, what they did is they went back 3 days later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it might have been a week later. One thing about the Vietnamese, they always take away their wounded and their dead.
Mm-hmm.
But when we went... When we left there, they were, the artillery and those guys were under orders to keep that place pounded so that we'd have a chance to go back and see what was there.
Mm-hmm.
So they kept artillery going in on and around there for 3 days before somebody finally went back there. I was in the hospital at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to the guys after they got back, and they said that they counted like 106 bodies of the North Vietnamese. And that was after 3 days of shelling and mm-hmm. trying to keep them guys from taking those people away.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all big guys, really big. They weren't like little short Vietnamese people.
Interesting. And so this is, you heard this from other Marines that went
from
back
the
there.
From the guys in my squad after I got out of the hospital and rejoined the unit.
Yeah.
I was in the hospital for 20 days.
What happened?
Well, I got dysentery and dehydration
mm-hmm.
from drinking bad water or something out of one of them bomb craters where we were at.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when you went back, well, when you were pulled out and removed from LZ Loon, what was your squad or your platoon strength?
There was only 7 of us.
In the platoon?
Out of the platoon of 45.
Wow. How many of them were wounded?
Quite a few of them were wounded. I was on the last chopper to leave, mm-hmm. and the chopper that left before me got shot down. And a couple of the guys out of that chopper survived, and they ran up the hill and got onto our chopper mm-hmm. as we were leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And they found out the one guy had 2 broken legs, and they ran up the hill. He left behind his 8-millimeter movie projector, though. He'd been taking a movie of that whole day,
mm-hmm.
but he lost it in that chopper crash.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of the crazy stuff that goes around. This Corporal Cook, he was popping popcorn and passing it out to the guys. He was over with the captain on their hill,
mm-hmm.
and he was popping Jiffy Pop using little pieces of C4. C4 is an explosive, plastic explosive,
mm-hmm.
but if you burned it, it wouldn't explode. And we used to rip off little pieces and use it to heat up our food.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like you said, the fighting on the other hill must not have been very intense.
No, not as much, yeah.
Any idea of the overall size of the enemy unit you were up against there?
They said it was like a couple of regiments of North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure how many a couple of regiments are.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a few.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned bringing in some some napalm airstrikes. What about conventional airstrikes? The use of conventional bombs and things like that, and forward air controllers being on site to help you. Was there anything like that?
Yeah, we did have a what they call a forward observer.
Mm-hmm.
And he would call in the artillery strikes and also from the ships.
Mm-hmm.
The New Jersey was over there with their 16-inch guns.
Mm-hmm.
We used them a couple of times. And artillery strikes were quite common. I mean, we used those all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The jets we only used when we got in real big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, like that day.
Mm-hmm.
We were in really deep trouble.
Mm-hmm.
We probably wouldn't have survived. At least the 7 of us that finally got out of there would not have survived to the next day.
Mm-hmm.
We would have been POWs or dead.
Did you receive any kind of resupply while you were there during that action?
No. No, we were lucky to get medevac choppers in.
Yeah.
It was just too hot there. Too much gunfire going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so after you you got out of there, you were in the hospital for about 20 days.
I went to Quezon first.
Oh, you went to Quezon first.
Quezon, yeah. When we got choppered off LZ Loon there, uh-huh. our 7 guys went to Quezon.
Okay. And what did you do there?
We tried to make contact with our battalion to find out where our company was, if those guys all got wiped out, or where we were going to go.
Uh-huh.
And it took 3 days, and they finally told us that some of the guys survived, and they were at Vandegrift Combat Base. So then they choppered us from Quezon over to Vandegrift.
Uh-huh.
And that's the first time that I ever saw a Marine Corps captain cry.
Mm.
He was so happy to see us because he thought we were all dead.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at Vandegrift for several days. Then we went out on another operation, and that's when I got that dysentery.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to remember. I might have my dates messed up a little bit. But I remember maybe it was June 6th I was in the hospital, or maybe that was the day I got wounded. I can't remember now. It's in my little Bible.
Okay.
That's home.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, real quick question about Quezon. What was it like there?
Quezon?
Yeah, when you got there. What was it like? Had they pretty much recovered from the siege? Or?
Yeah, but it was I just couldn't believe that we had a base down in a valley. I just, man, you got all these big hills around here. What are we doing way down here?
Mm-hmm.
So who's up on those hills? Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
That hill 681 that they talked about, or 881.
Mm-hmm.
That was those hills on the north side of Quezon there, and those are the ones they kept going up and kicking the gooks off of, and then they'd leave and come back down, and then they'd have to go back up there again. And I said, man, that's crazy stuff. Why don't they just flatten that sucker?
Mm.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And the base wasn't in too bad a disarray. They'd been steadily restocking it after the Tet, was
mm-hmm.
Over.
Mm-hmm.
But the runway, there was only one runway that they were able to use. And at one time they had three runways there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was... We were more concerned about finding our guys and
mm-hmm.
what kind of shape Quezon was in.
Yeah, of course. Well, yeah. At this point, what were your thoughts about being in Vietnam? I mean, did you think that you were that you had made a mistake, maybe? Or what were you feeling? What were you thinking?
Not a thing. Just wanting to get my time over and
uh-huh.
get the hell out of there.
Okay. What was your opinion of the enemy at this point? Do you remember?
Well, I knew that our intelligence wasn't worth a damn.
Mm.
And that we had to kind of fly by the seat of our pants because those intelligence people couldn't be depended on. They really didn't know what was going on over there, at least where we were at.
Mm-hmm.
I spent all my time from the south side of the DMZ, the border there, and the Red China Sea,
mm-hmm.
all the way over to the Laotian border. I walked across there twice. It's 15 miles. And we spent our whole time doing search and clear operations, just searching out the enemy and getting rid of them. And some of the stuff we ran into wasn't in any of the intelligence reports that we received.
Mm-hmm. And it was during this period, between, say, June and December of 68, that you were conducting operations on the Ho Chi Minh Trail and into Laos, that kind of stuff?
Right.
Okay. Did you yourself, so you yourself did go and conduct ambushes on the trail?
Right.
Did you make contact in those, during those?
Always.
Why don't you go ahead and describe what those operations were like?
Well, we'd go down and... it was about, I think 3,000 meters from our base camp up in the northwest corner of South Vietnam, because you could see the DMZ,
mm-hmm.
and you could see into Laos where we were at on top of this hill. And we'd watch the Vietnamese come across and then cut the corner and go into Laos and head south. And we watched them for several nights, in a couple of days before we the captain set up these search and clear operations, or what they called killer teams. And we'd take seven guys and we'd space ourselves out going down the hill and we'd take Claymore mines and set them up both sides of the trail. We'd put like six out on one side and six out on the other side and offset them. They had a killing radius of 100 yards to the front and 30 or 40 yards to the rear. And they were loaded with double-op buck. And then we'd have one guy go back with the cord. And then we'd have one signal guy that would go through the jungle and signal when they were coming. And then he'd come back and join the guy that had the trigger. And they'd wait for the what they thought would be the gasoline truck or an ammunition truck. And then they'd set them off. And we wouldn't wait around. I mean, those two guys would run back to the next guy, and then there'd be three of them, then there'd be four, then there'd be five, then there'd be six, and we'd be home. So we had guys spaced down the hill, single guys spaced down the hill, so that we'd have contact with each one as we came back up the hill. And actually, two guys would be the only two guys that we'd be down on the Ho Chi Minh Trail there, setting up the ambush, putting out the Claymore mines and running the line across.
Okay. And what was the usual size of the enemy units you'd engage there?
We never knew because it was dark and at night and in the jungle, and we'd do this in different spots because once you blew one area, it blew all the trees and stuff away.
Mm-hmm.
And we never knew what was coming. You know, we'd just figure on that day was a good day, and we'd go down there. There was only a couple of times that the guys went down there and nobody showed up. I mean, this was a daily ritual for these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Every night they'd be coming down that trail, trying to resupply the south.
And you mentioned sometimes you would, when you were on the trail hitting these targets, that there'd be fuel and things like that. Would there be many secondary explosions?
Oh yeah, a lot of secondary explosions if we're lucky. I remember one time the guys laughed because they blew up the water truck.
Okay.
They said, shit, we thought it was the gas truck, it was the water truck.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, funny things like that happen.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time they were able to get the ammo truck or a fuel truck for refueling.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, the jungle got real bright then.
Okay. And, about how many of those missions did you yourself conduct, you remember?
I just went on one.
Okay. What was your opinion of the leadership in your unit?
Very good. Very good until we got this one lieutenant in from right out of officer's candidate school. He was kind of a lame brain. That was, I'm trying to remember where we were at. We were at Vandergriff when he got there, I think it was, yeah. I think that's where we were. Basically, all I remember about this guy was, I think he got there in, like, September of 68. Because I remember in October he was gone. We got rid of him. He shot himself in the foot with his 45 after one operation. Another operation, I relieved him of his command because he was getting guys killed, and we had a squad that went into a valley and got pinned down by a machine gun, and he sent the next squad in and they got pinned down instead of calling in artillery and taking out the damn thing. He said, we can get it. I think he saw too many war movies. Anyway, I got down to my squad. I was the last squad they was going to send in there, and I says, I got my guys together, and I said, hey, I said, this isn't going to happen. I says, I'm taking over this platoon, and we're going to do this the right way. So we disarmed him and told him that he was no longer in charge, and we called in an airstrike and took care of the ambush and got our guys back. Just a couple guys got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, when we got back to the rear area, and the captain had his little talk with me and that lieutenant, I ended up going to Okinawa for 7 days to non-commissioned officer school. And when I came back, that lieutenant was gone. He was no longer with the company.
Mm-hmm.
But I was able to notice that when I left country that his signature is at the bottom of my order sheet. So I knew that he still was in country, but he was in the rear area.
Mm-hmm.
Where he was safe and couldn't hurt anybody.
Mm-hmm. And did your company commander tell you that he thought you did the right thing?
We never really discussed it.
Mm.
I just went to officers. They just told me I was in trouble, and I went to non-commissioned officers candidate school, and when I came back, everything was better.
Okay. So, but you never got in trouble or anything?
No. Just said it was a ballsy thing to do.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
That's the kind of guy I am, I guess.
Well, were there ever any threats of violence against leaders that were incompetent?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had a gunnery sergeant that came over to Vietnam. Gunny Kern was his name. It was C-U-R-R-A-N. He was a big old guy. I mean, he wasn't tall, but he was big around because he spent too many hours in the non-commissioned officer's lounge. And he had like 20-some years in the Marine Corps and never been to war. And he so much wanted to be a leader. And they made him our platoon leader when he came in country. And he was screwing up, steady screwing up. And I'd try to talk to him. And he says, you see these stripes here, Sergeant? Speaking about the two lower stripes, because a gunny has got three up and two down. And he'd point at mine and say, see, the three up. He says, well, I got two down. I'm the boss. Well, anyway, he woke up with several nights with grenades underneath his pillow in various stages of ready.
Mm-hmm.
The first time he just had a grenade stuck underneath his pillow with the pin and everything in it. The next time he had a grenade stuck underneath his pillow with just a rubber band around it. And I think after that time he got the picture, because he kind of straightened up after that. And I would say in about 6 weeks' time he went from about 220 pounds to about 135 pounds. Because he went from an extra, extra large uniform down to an extra small uniform.
Wow.
And he turned out to be a pretty good guy. He just, he was just messed up with command, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Being a big shot, being a boss. And say, hey, I mean, you got corporals and sergeants over here that got a lot more experience in a war than you do, and you're making mistakes, and it's going to cost you.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally woke up. I don't know whoever did all the bad things, and I didn't want to know because I was the sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
But I know some of the younger guys, you know, were doing that to him. But I just never bothered to find out who.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked out okay because he didn't get killed, and he spent his time over there, and he did a good job after that.
Okay. And did you have the same company commander the whole time you were with him?
Uh-huh, yep. Yep, can't remember his name. He was from Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about, you mentioned that NCO spending too much time in the NCO club. What about recreational activities in general? How frequently could you guys take a break and relax? You know, what kind of facilities were available, that kind of stuff?
None.
Okay.
The only relaxation we got was if we didn't have to go on patrol at night and sitting around and BSing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of guys played cards. Several of the guys carried a deck of cards with them, and they played cards, played poker, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Did you have much access to beer, alcohol?
No. I remember. Yeah, I got a picture. You got to see. It's got cases of beer stacked up, and myself and this other sergeant, we got back to Vandegrift Combat Base one time. And we were pissed because we were, you know, you're supposed to get two beers a day when you're in country. And when you go on operation for 45 days, well, that's 90 beers that we built up. And we got back to the rear area, and they told us they didn't have any beer for us. So myself and Sergeant Monroe went on a little excursion, and we found where the CBs were. Them guys always had tons of beer. And we borrowed about 20 cases, took them back to our guys and gave it to them.
Mm-hmm.
We stole a mule. That was a little all-wheel drive thing.
Mm-hmm.
We called a mule.
Mm-hmm.
And loaded up all that beer, took it over to our place, and then we ditched the mule someplace. And they came by a couple days later asking us where we got our beer, and we said, oh, we had it coming to us. We've been gone on an operation for 45 days, and they owed us 90 beers apiece.
Mm-hmm.
We had these cases of beer all stacked up. But, they had some terrible taste of beer. They had that Falstaff over there, and Blatt's, and a couple other different ones that were just terrible. You never got it cold. You mm-hmm. always had to drink it warm, and this wasn't very good. Of course, my dad kept me in alcohol. My dad would send what I called a care package,
mm-hmm.
and he'd send me these little cans of fruit, fresh fruit, peaches, apricots, mm-hmm. pears, and then he'd send me a bottle of brandy every week.
Okay.
And what I used to do is take that bottle of brandy, and because we had to put these pills in our water to purify them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, and he sent me Kool-Aid, too. At first, we just had the Kool-Aid to take the taste away from the water. But then I talked him into sending me bottles of blackberry brandy mm-hmm. to mix with the Kool-Aid, because the Kool-Aid wasn't enough to take away that real strong taste.
Mm-hmm.
So I had one canteen that had brandy and Kool-Aid in it, and the other one just had Kool-Aid in it. And that's what I carried when I was out in the bush.
Okay. And what about drug use?
Pardon?
What about drug use? Is there any drug use here?
Very little. Like I said, we were up in the northern part, and the availability of drugs was very slim. I know we had a couple guys when they went on R&R, and they flew out of Da Nang to go on R&R, when they came back, they brought back some marijuana with them.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always my philosophy that you don't need to be doing that stuff. And if I caught them doing it, they'd be going to the Hooskow. So they were really careful. If they did do it, they didn't do it around me.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, you said they'd be going where?
To the Hooskow. The brig.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew I meant business. I mean, it was our lives at stake and mm-hmm. their life at stake. And,
mm-hmm.
And I think the guys that did drugs over there basically did drugs before they went over there.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys that didn't do drugs before they went over there
mm-hmm.
didn't do drugs while they were there. At least in our unit, that seemed to be the way, the flow of things. there was only like a couple guys out of our whole company that that I remember doing drugs at all. Mm-hmm. And they were flat ass told that if we caught them with it, they'd be going. Because you didn't need that kind of stuff, you know, when your life depended on everybody. Everybody mm-hmm. had to be straight, because it seemed like every time we went out on operation, we got in the shed, and you know, you need somebody all doped up and thinking badly. You know, thinking wrong, mm-hmm. making big mistakes.
And what about problems with animals?
Yeah, I remember one place we were at, we lost two guys to Bengal tigers.
Whoa.
I mean, we were up on this hill, and these guys were out on a, what you call a, an outpost.
Mm-hmm.
So they were out in front of the lines, probably 60, 70, 80 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we told them before they went out there to make sure they stayed awake, because there were tigers, and we ran into elephants in this area, and it was in that same area up in the north northwest corner there where we did our little kill operations.
Mm-hmm.
It was in that same terrain, not from the same fire base, but from a different fire base in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And one night all we heard was a blood-curdling scream and nothing, quiet. And the next day we went out and went down to where these guys were at, and all we saw was these just humongous paw prints. And we knew they got taken away.
Hmm. Both guys?
Both guys, gone.
How many tigers do you think?
Oh, I don't know. There was probably a couple,
mm-hmm.
two or three.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of tracks around there, so...
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know how much, you know, how much wrestling around they did or anything like that before they hauled them away.
My goodness. no, these guys that were in your squad?
No. Okay. No, they were in another squad. We were on this hill with another company. There was our company and another company. And these guys were with the other company.
Okay. How would they handle reporting something like that back in terms of casualty reporting? Do you know?
I have not a clue. It'd be interesting to see what they said, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I have not a clue.
And you mentioned in the questionnaire that there was also running with bamboo vipers?
Yeah. On this one hill we were on, we were on patrol one day, and this green snake came down and bit one of the guys, and luckily bit him in the face. I think it was in the face.
Hmm.
And they had to medevac him out of there, but he survived.
He did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Eddie got bitten in the neck or somewhere close to a major artery, though. They said he would have died.
Wow.
Well, we got the medevac chopper in there really quick and
mm-hmm.
Hauled him away.
Mm-hmm. And that's the only
incident. That's the only time
snakes?
I ever ran into those snakes.
Huh.
They actually hung down from the bamboo trees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a lot of varying terrain over there. I mean, we went from this what they called elephant grass areas in the valleys to
mm-hmm.
up on the hills where you ran into bamboo and real thick jungle
mm-hmm.
and other places where there were rivers and waterfalls.
Mm-hmm.
In some of the places, that hill where the guy got bit by the bamboo viper, I actually took bamboo and made a cover over my foxhole, and then took banana leaves and covered up the bamboo
mm-hmm.
so that I wouldn't get wet. And several of the other guys did the same thing after they saw me doing it, because...
Mm-hmm.
It kind of blended in more with the foliage.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty thick jungle there. I mean, we didn't want the Vietnamese to know we were there. And we were were going to be there for a few days. We were doing operations around there, and I think that's the same hill we were on when we found the hospital, underground hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty demoralizing when they came out with all that stuff that said, from your friends at Berkeley College, or University of California, Berkeley or something like that on the damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was, we were pretty pissed off about that.
Now, had you heard a lot about the anti-war movement before and during your time in Vietnam?
No, hadn't heard a lot. The big thing over there was the riots in Detroit and
mm-hmm.
L.A. and different places because they were, like, close to home.
Mm. And was there anything else that was interesting or anything else you want to talk about with regard to your time from June to December before you went to the to become an advisor with the MPs? Oh, maybe with the Vietnamese police?
I'm trying to think of if we had any more interesting experiences. Well, that hill that we were on in the northwest corner there doing those killer team deals, one day the colonel got off the helicopter and he ran about 30 feet away from the helicopter and took a direct hit from a rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been coming in about every 3-4 days onto this hill and meeting with the captains. Like I said, there was two companies on this hill, so there was two captains there, and he'd come in about every 3 days and meet with them. And that one day they took him out.
Mm-hmm.
It was something. Right. I have a picture of him running from the helicopter, but my stupid camera, I couldn't get the picture after that, because
mm-hmm.
that Brownie camera, for some reason, was real slow.
Mm-hmm.
But I did get a picture of him coming off the helicopter and running, but I don't have a picture of after the bomb exploded.
Mm-hmm.
I've got that in my photographs.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of my rolls of film that I sent to my dad.
Mm-hmm.
He got processed for me.
Okay.
Let's see, what else? Another patrol we were on, we were winding down this hill, and the guys in the back, there were some new guys in the back of the line
mm-hmm.
that heard all this noise, and they opened fire, and it was our guys that were up in front. The trail had wound back around
mm-hmm.
like in a snake pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So the guys were actually shooting at our own guys. And it took us a few minutes to get them to cease fire, and we had one casualty that we had to helicopter out. That was a bad place. We had to drop a line down from a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to strap this guy in, and they had to pull him up. Then there was another time when we were talking. We were talking BS, and we hadn't seen any action for a couple of weeks. And we were on this hill, and the company commander said take a break, so we were all spreading out to take a break. This one guy goes out in front of the line to take a crap and get shot in the leg while he's taking a crap. So we had to helicopter him out. He says, of all things, he says, I'm busy taking a crap and I had to shoot my ass. some of the historical things, or hysterical things, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
One time we were overwhelmed by a bunch of VC or Vietnamese on a patrol, and we had to call in an emergency evacuation, and we were on a hill that backed up to a cliff, and we had our backs to the wall, and we had to take C4 and blast these trees over the hill to make a spot big enough for the helicopter to at least get one be able to land with one skid on
mm-hmm.
the hill
mm-hmm.
and make room for the blades.
Mm-hmm.
And we got out of there, and we hit some hit some trees going down, because they dropped right off into the valley and to pick up speed to get out of there real quick because the Vietnamese were real close to us. And when we got back to Vandergriff, they told us to go out the back of the helicopter and run as fast as you can go and go straight out of the back. And what had happened is it had broken that cowling back there, and as soon as the blade slowed down enough where the U-joints took effect, that blade just tipped right over and smashed into the ground. So we were pretty fortunate that that helicopter stayed together as long as it did together. So, I mean, it took us 20 minutes to get back to Vandergriff. And I guess the fact that it took the commanding general of the 3rd Marine Division 3 days to find me, and that was when we were up in that northwest corner there. But we were away from that, you know, away from that LZ. We were on another operation south of there, and it was kind of funny that it took them 3 days to find us.
And that's when you went...
That's when I went to work for as an advisor, yeah. Everybody was bugging me. Who in Washington do you know? Who in Washington do you know? What senators in your back pocket? I said, I don't know anybody, honest.
Well, you know, what did you, when you went and talked with the people at the military advisory group, they were the MACVI, what did they tell you you'd be doing, and, you know,
well, first of all, they helicoptered me out of the bush and took me back to Quang Tri. And then I was supposed to meet with the commanding general, but they made me go take a shower and put on all new clean clothes and new boots. And I'd been out in the bush for, oh, probably 40 days out of a 45-day operation, so I was pretty grungy, and they didn't want the general to meet me like that. I said, well, why not? He says, let them know what it's really like out there. No, 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 no. So after some argument, I finally took my shower and put on my clean clothes, and I got in a helicopter, and they helicoptered me over to Da Nang somewhere. Was it Da Nang? No, it wasn't Da Nang. Where was it? I think it was Dong Ha they took me to. Yeah, the next Quang Tri was one city, and then Dong Ha was the next city over. So they helicoptered me over from Quang Tri over to Dong Ha to meet with the general. And he's the one that told me that I'd be... My orders were cut, so I got transferred from Charlie Company to Headquarters Battalion. Headquarters Company, Headquarters Battalion, still in 4th Marines, but that I'd be temporarily assigned to a Army MACV unit in Quang Tri City. And my basis of operation would be I would work with this MACV unit, or be assigned to it, but I'd actually be working with a civilian from the State Department, would be my boss. And I later came to find out that he was a 20-year Army veteran and been in Vietnam since 1965, and he actually worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, but he was assigned to the State Department, quote, signed as an advisor. And he was a good guy, though. He was a good guy. I learned a lot from him. And my duties were to... get the Vietnamese police field forces organized, and I'd be the coordinator between them and the Marine Corps, and I'd meet with the commanding general every few days, and we'd set up operations for the next week of which villages that we'd go in and search for Vietnamese sympathizers, Viet Cong supervisors, and food caches and weapons caches. And so the plan would be all laid out, and the Marines would go in the night before and surround the village and not let anybody in or out. And then the next day, first thing daylight, we'd go in there with our Vietnamese police and do a hut-to-hut search.
Mm-hmm.
The very first one I went on, we came under fire, and the captain of the police department, who was the boss of the field forces, he and I, after several minutes, looked around and realized that we were the only two guys left. So we went back outside the village, and he found his guys, and they told him the next morning they'd have a meeting. And the next morning they had a meeting, and he started from the lowest guy and worked his way up, chewing butt, chewing butt, chewing butt, and he got to the lieutenant, chewed his butt, pulled out his .45 and shot him right in the forehead. I said, whoa, time out. I had to go talk to my boss and say, hey, can I do this? He said, oh yeah, this is their country, they can do whatever they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay. So that was kind of a shocker, but we never had that problem again. When we went into a village to search the village, we searched the village.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what your boss's name was?
Walter Boiling.
Do you know if he's still alive?
I have no idea. Okay. I don't even know how you spell his last name.
Because
that was always a controversy between him and I. He'd spell it one way and I'd spell it another way, and he'd say no and he'd spell it a different way. So I don't know even if that was his real name.
Okay.
It could have been Bolin, Boiling, Bowling.
Okay.
But I do know that he was a master sergeant in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was assigned to the State Department via the Central Intelligence Agency.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he had a wife that was from Japan, Japanese wife.
And you are sure of his first name?
Huh?
You are sure of his first name?
Walter?
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure that's his first name.
Okay. Because
he always talked to me. You know, he introduced himself as Walt.
Okay.
He didn't tell me his last name for a long time.
Yeah. Okay. What kind of guidance or briefings, training, anything did you get before you were actually thrown out into the field with this the national police?
They really never gave me any actual training. They just told me what the concept was and
mm-hmm.
what their mission was,
mm-hmm.
and I just gave them what guidance I could as far as. From a military standpoint, I think basically they just wanted me there to assist them in a military-style operation as far as searching the houses from, you know,
mm-hmm.
one at a time and making sure that you always had some guy on the outside to protect the guy that was on the inside. Never send everybody into the hut at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my job was just to teach them procedurally how to go about searching house to house.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about acting as a liaison between the National Police Force and Marine units that would secure those villages? Did you do any work like that?
Yep, that's what I did. I met with the general every week, mm-hmm. and we'd set up one or two villages that would be searched for VC sympathizers. And so once a week I would meet with the commanding general and go over it, and I'd mark on the map where it was going to be at and the coordinates, and then he would contact the Marines that were in that area there, and they'd go around and circle that village, and we'd do our thing, and I'd meet with the Marine lieutenant or captain, whoever was out there, and advise them. You know, that was my contact, and that's when I told them that we're going in now, and we'd go in, search the village, and when we were done, we'd go out and we'd talk to them, and they always took away any prisoners that we got, and they were taken to intelligence to be interrogated.
Okay. Did you capture a lot? of people when you went on these operations?
Just a few people that were suspect.
Okay.
And they were taken back to the rear area and questioned.
Mm-hmm. And did you uncover a lot of cash supplies, food, weapons, medical
supplies?
Not too
many. We found a lot of places where they had stuff there, but they had removed it, and nobody in the village knew anything about it, of course.
Mm-hmm. And
the biggest thing that, one of the bigger things that I had to deal with was the Vietnamese police guys going in and pillaging these houses, especially if they didn't have people in them. And sometimes when they had people in them, they would assault the women. And that was another thing to deal with, because the Vietnamese field police were very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were like God, and these people couldn't do anything, you know, against them. So that was another one of my jobs, is, you know, getting them to understand that they couldn't be doing this stuff. They were the police, they were the protector, and they weren't the aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't to take advantage of young women, and
how receptive was the National Police leadership to your advice in that regard?
Well, the captain was ended up being a pretty good friend, and my interpreter ended up being a pretty good friend, but the actual policemen, they got away with whatever they could get away with. You could see it all the time, you know, every operation we went on, that they'd steal stuff. Because the village was big, and you couldn't keep your eye on everybody. And I knew, you know, you could, and I would stand back a lot of times, and I wouldn't go all the way into the village. I'd stay on the outside edge and watch, observe. And I also would tell the Marines, if they saw any of the Vietnamese police guys coming out of there carrying anything, to get it from them.
Mm.
So it was pretty well taken care of, but they still did it.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have, due to the fact that they couldn't get many Vietnamese police or any Vietnamese people to be police, their discipline was almost non-existent, other than the fact that that captain shot that one lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
and then promoted the next guy, and they kind of all knew that, say, hey, this could happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of towed the line a little bit better after that. But there were little incidences that, you know, went on.
Mm-hmm. And how often would you meet and, like, get debriefed about the operations you went on?
Well, that would be the meeting that I would have with the general.
Mm-hmm.
Would be a debriefing and a briefing on the next operation,
mm-hmm.
all in the same day.
What about the stuff you did with Walt Bowen?
That stuff I would talk to the general about and tell him what we were doing. Because
mm-hmm.
what we did is we set up a field office
mm-hmm.
north of Dong Ha on the road to there was a couple of army bases out there. It would be toward the northeast corner of South Vietnam. And there was a bunch of villages around there. So we were building a outpost, so to speak, to help keep track of that traffic that was on that highway. Because there's too many places for them to turn off before they really reached Dong Ha.
Mm-hmm.
And where nobody questioned their movement. So when I left, we were just finishing up that that outpost.
Mm-hmm.
But the little village, there's a CAP unit there, an army unit in this village, probably about 50 meters or so from this compound we were building. And I went over there one day, and they had 50 caliber machine guns set up in the corners of the village, but nobody knew how to use them. So I spent like 2 days over there teaching those guys how to use those 50 caliber machine guns, which wasn't part of my job, but, you know, it was part of my job as a person to let them know how to use the weapons that they had.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of unit was this again?
Pardon?
What kind of unit was this?
It was a CAP unit, they call it, Combined Action Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And that was with the Army, and the Army would send these groups of guys in to the villages to make friends and help the villages with villagers with sickness and eating habits and stuff like that, hygiene.
Okay. And I was curious, you work with the National Police. Did you ever hear at that point while you were in country working with them, the Fung Hong program or the Phoenix program?
No.
Okay.
No.
And were any of the operations you went on designed specifically to capture someone? I mean, you knew going in, this person's there and we need to capture him or kill him.
Well, we had several of those.
Mm-hmm. Any idea what the makeup of that person was in terms of, you know, why?
No, I knew was they were a bad guy, and mm-hmm. it was our job to capture him or eliminate him.
Okay. Anything else that you remember or want to discuss about your time with the National Police?
Oh, let's see. Let's see. Oh, yeah, one time I got a speeding ticket from an MP. I was on Highway 1 going from Quang Tri to Dong Ha,
mm-hmm.
and he pulled me over to give me a speeding ticket. And this was when I was working with the Vietnamese Field Force Police.
Mm-hmm.
I got so mad at him. I made him take me back to Dong Ha to talk to his captain.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally chewed him out. Then his captain chewed him out. And I made him take me back to my vehicle. When I got back to my vehicle, the little gook kids in the village near where I'd left my scout had broken into it and stole my camera.
Oh.
Boy, that made me mad.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that guy wanted to lock me up. Couldn't believe it.
What was the largest cache that you guys uncovered? Do you remember?
I don't remember, no.
Were there any significant weapons caches in particular, or?
Very few. Okay. Very few weapons. Most of the caches that we found were empty.
Mm-hmm.
But you could tell that stuff had been there just from packaging, mm-hmm. you know, pieces of paper and stuff that were left behind
mm-hmm.
that were broken off the packages or came off the packages.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall ever finding anything that pertinent in that northern area there.
Did this raise any flags for you guys? I mean, if you are getting ready to conduct an operation in a village and cache is suddenly moved before you get there, an indication perhaps that they know you're coming and they want to move that stuff before you get there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we figured that one of the guys in the Vietnamese police was an informer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was there any way to vet that person out, or did you guys do anything to
There was
to
really
stop
no
that?
Way to, because they had so much freedom outside of the actual operations that we went on that, when it really came down to it, it was the province chief
mm-hmm.
and the chief of police that were the big guys,
mm-hmm.
and they mysteriously got killed while I was gone on R&R in Australia.
Oh. Both of them?
Both of them, yeah. They were going down to Da Nang in a jeep, and they got blown up coming back. So I think that was part of the intelligence stuff that we were working on.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know I talked to Walt quite a bit about those two guys and their activities, because you always saw them around the known drug places, and you always saw them around the whorehouses. Because I actually lived right in Quangtree Village during this time in a room or a house that was a really well-built house that was fortified with sandbags, and we had concertina wire around, and on the other side of the house was the river, Quangtree River. One of the interesting things I did is when I had some downtime in between operations is I went over to the contacted the recon guys that were at the bridge that went across the Quangtree River and got them to take me down into the river to see what they did. They dove almost every other hour on the hour to check the bridge for explosives. Because that was the main bridge going over the Quangtree River that allowed people to go from Quangtree to Dong Ha, points north and east and west from there. It was a big, you know, suspension bridge, all steel and concrete. So it could have been blown up relatively easily. Wouldn't take a lot of explosives to weaken it. And so that was kind of interesting to go down there, and man, that water is crystal clear. Just amazing.
Okay. Is anything else that you want to talk about with regard to your time with the police?
They just, other than the fact they let me pick my successor.
Okay.
And I picked a guy by the name of John Smiley. He was the he was on his second tour over there, and he was a sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
And his second tour over there, he worked in the rear area as a supply guy. And I used to get pants and stuff from him for my Vietnamese police. And he was a pretty good guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I got him to take my spot when I left.
Mm-hmm.
He had like 8 or 9 months to do over there on his second tour.
And how long after you finished your work with the police force did you leave country?
Well, as soon as I left, he took over probably the day before I left.
Okay.
And I went to, let's see, well, while I was with, I went on R&R while I was with the Vietnamese police, too.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Australia for 7 days, the first week in April, 69.
How was that?
Oh, that was very nice. I really enjoyed that. And when I came back, I only had about 7 weeks left.
Mm-hmm.
I think my day to leave was like the 26th of May.
Okay.
So on the 24th of May, I think John Smiley took over.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down to Da Nang to wait to leave.
Mm-hmm.
A couple things interesting that happened to me over there is one time when I was going, I think it was when I was going on R&R, I ran into a guy from California that had been stationed in California with me.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived not too far apart in Michigan, maybe 50, 60 miles. And we ran into each other twice over there. I think the first time when I was going on R&R, and then I ran into him again when I came back from R&R. And then Dennis Burke, my the one of the corporals that was at Vietnamese language school, he was a air traffic controller at Quangtree. So whenever I got into Quangtree, I'd go visit him. And a couple of times his boss, a lieutenant, would tell Dennis to tell me to leave before he had me arrested. I was pretty pretty belligerent. I had a lot of power for a sergeant, you know, and I didn't have too much respect for some of them guys that just came from Officer's Candidate School, and they just came over there and were doing their time and had cushy jobs and got to play basketball and stuff like that and go to the club, you know, NCO club every night or officer's club every night. So I kind of picked on the one guy quite a bit. So he told Dennis to get me the hell out of there. So then the next day I had to leave and go back to my unit. Mm-hmm. That was before I became an advisor to the Vietnamese police. Mm-hmm. That was while I was out in the bush. Mm-hmm. I think probably when I came back, it might have been when I got out of the hospital. I went from like 175 pounds down to 130 pounds in about 6-7 days. Mm-hmm. That dysentery and dehydration.
What would you typically eat when you're in the field?
Sea rations.
Okay.
And one of my meals, after I became an advisor to the Vietnamese police, I had access to these, what they called long-range patrol rations.
Mm-hmm.
One package was supposed to do you for a day.
Mm-hmm.
I used to eat three of those packages a day.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't take me long to gain my weight back. I think I was like 175, 180 when I left country. So I was able to, over a period of time, get my weight back.
Mm-hmm. When you were working in Quang Tri City, did you eat on the economy at all?
The economy.
Yeah, the civilian food? The Vietnamese food?
Oh, yeah, yep. I ate a little bit of dog, a little bit of cat.
Okay.
Seaweed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, those guys were always bringing in food to eat, you know. They'd say, yeah, try this.
And what do you remember about the day you left?
Pardon?
What do you remember most about the day you left?
Please don't have a strike on the airbase while I'm leaving. Let me get out of here clean.
Mm-hmm. Was that a frequent occurrence?
Oh, yeah.
Rocketing and mortaring of the...
Of the airbases, yeah.
There in Quang Tri?
Quang Tri, Da Nang, Phu Bai, Chu Lai, all them places used to get shelled regular.
Where did you depart the country from?
Da Nang.
Okay.
Came in there and left from there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't think I was ever any further south than that, Da Nang. I never was down in Saigon. Mm-hmm. I was in Hue a couple of times while I was an advisor to the Vietnamese police.
Mm-hmm.
There are several little excursions Walt and I took when he was doing some of his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And one time they brought in a captain, a guy that retired as a captain from the California Highway Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to be my new boss. And he ate something wrong or did something wrong, and he got really sick, and they put him out on the hospital ship Hope.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter and I one day took a helicopter and flew out there and to check on him, see how he was doing. That was quite an experience, landing on a ship out in the middle of the ocean.
Because
the seas were a little bit rough, and the helicopter had time his landing just right so that he didn't get pounded when he landed.
Mm-hmm.
He had to make sure the ship wasn't coming up when he was coming down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was kind of an interesting experience.
Mm-hmm. How was that that police captain?
He was pretty good, but he didn't last long. His I don't know if he was nervous, overly nervous, or what his problem was, but he didn't last long. He was only there a few weeks, and he was on his way home. And another time I hopped a ride with a guy to Da Nang. I had a couple of days I had to get down to Da Nang and meet somebody for something. I can't remember what it was. I think I had a meeting down there. It was when I was with the Vietnamese police, and I hopped a plane ride with this guy, and it was one of those two-seater observer planes.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing we did was go to North Vietnam. He said, I got to go check something out first before we go. I told him, I think you're turning the wrong way. He said, oh, I got to check something out before we go down there. So we flew over some part of North Vietnam and circled back around and got out over the ocean and headed back down to Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little nervous being in that little, just little Piper Club two-seater, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Man, alive.
Any idea what he was looking at?
I have no idea. He wouldn't say, and I didn't want to ask.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you said that when you were working with Walt, when he was doing his stuff, what stuff did he do typically?
Well, he basically, I think, was an intelligence guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent a lot of time getting intelligence on the province chief and the and chief of police there.
Okay.
You know, we spent a lot of time, him and I, spying on those two guys.
Okay. So you think they were crooked?
Yeah, no doubt about it. Okay. Yeah. We think they're crooks and they're North Vietnamese sympathizers.
Okay. Any idea who eventually killed them?
Well, I think probably our guys did.
Okay.
I think they, an errant 155 round probably got him.
Okay. Alright. Okay, go ahead.
I remember driving one time from Da Nang up to Quang Tri in my scout. And coming across these military police guys and telling us, oh, you can't go there. The VC have taken over the road. And I says, how long you guys been out here? He says, oh, a couple hours. I says, well, we were just through there going to Da Nang, and we're turning around coming back. I says, there's nothing going on up there. Oh, yes, there is. Yes, there is. We drove, Walt and I drove through there, and there was nothing going on. So that was another thing. Their intelligence over there was very poor.
Mm-hmm.
Very poor.
All right, well, thank you, sir. I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording for now.
Okay.
This has been the first interview with Mr. Keith Erdman.
This is Steve Maxter continuing the interview with Mr. Erdman on the 6th of March, 2001 at approximately 9 a.m. Lubbock time. Mr. Erdman, why don't you go ahead and discuss the trip home as you were traveling from Vietnam to the United States.
Well, the first leg of the trip went from Da Nang to Okinawa, and we were in Okinawa for 3 days for debriefing and winding down and some attempts to get guys to re-up for more time in the service because most of us were past our halfway point. The debriefing stuff was really, really not that great. I think more or less it was just a winding down period before the arduous trip across the ocean. Flew, I think it was like 20-some hours from Okinawa to, we landed in Eastern California out by Riverside. I don't know if it was Edwards Air Force Base or some other base. And then we had to rush to get cabs to catch our plane to Chicago, and at that time the cabbies were having a war and they were turning each other in for speeding and saying they were drunk driving and stuff like that. So we happened to get stopped by the highway patrol on our way to LAX, but it didn't last too long. We got to LAX in time to catch our plane. We got to Chicago O'Hare and were unable to catch a plane. We would have had to stay overnight and catch a plane in the morning, and ran into another guy that I knew that was in the military from the same city. He was on his way home on leave, and we ran into him, and I ran into a couple other guys that were going up to Grand Rapids and Muskegon. So we got together and rented a car and drove up, and the guy that was going to Grand Rapids, he put the car in his name because he was going to be the one that dropped it off, and we all split the cost. So we dropped the guy off in Muskegon, and we went up to Whitehall. Actually, my dad met us in Muskegon. Let me go back a little bit. My father came down and met us in Muskegon, so the guy from Grand Rapids wouldn't have to go too far out of his way to, so he could get home. And took us to Whitehall, where my dad lived. And, I think it was probably 10 o'clock at night. Maybe not that late. Yeah, it might have been 10 o'clock at night when we got there.
Okay. Let me ask you a quick question about the last day or so in Vietnam. Now, you mentioned the debriefing wasn't very thorough. What did you expect, and what would, I guess, what do you think would have been more appropriate? And why don't you describe what you mean by debriefing?
Well, they just basically talked to everybody and told us, you know, what to expect when we get home, and about the anti-war protest. Of course, we all knew about that because of the news coverage and stuff. Those of us that were, like, I was getting newspapers from home, so I knew about, you know, that kind of stuff. They made a big deal out of some things that seemed kind of trivial to me. I mean, my basic thing was, I'm home and I don't care what anybody thinks.
In what month and year did you arrive home? Just so it's on this record here.
May of 69.
May of 69. Yeah. Did you encounter any anti-war protesters when you first arrived, or shortly after that?
No, not in my town. We're Montague, Michigan was a very, Montague and Whitehall were very veteran-oriented mm-hmm. towns, and we didn't have the protesters and stuff like that.
Okay. Well, when you got back, did you attempt to join any of the veterans' organizations? You mentioned that it's a very veteran-oriented.
Oh, yeah, my dad was a World War II veteran, and he uh-huh. was president of the local VFW sometime prior to my going into service.
Okay.
So he got all of us guys that were getting out. He got us signed up in the VFW.
And that was in Whitehall?
In Montague.
In Montague.
3256. Post number 3256.
3256. Now, in your experience generally, especially there and even, you know, in talking to other veterans perhaps, or visiting other areas of the country, did you find that most VFW halls, how do they treat Vietnam veterans?
No different than any other veteran.
Okay. Okay. Well, how did your family react to your arrival home?
Oh, they were glad to see me.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time carousing the first few months I was home.
Okay.
Did a lot of drinking. And
mm-hmm.
My buddy Fred, the one I went in with, Fred Reed, he was stationed at Camp Lejeune when I got home. He was in the MPs. I called him up on the phone one night when a couple other guys and myself were at the bar, and I said, "Hey, you got to get home, man. We're partying. A bunch of us made it home. We're celebrating." So he conned his company commander into letting him fly home because his brother just got back from Vietnam, and we were like brothers. I mean, we went through school since fifth grade together and lived together when we got out of school, and then we signed up for the Marine Corps together. So we were like brothers, so it wasn't really just a little white lie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't blood brothers or anything like that, or whatever you want to call it. Anyway, he came home, and we partied all weekend, and I think we'd spent probably $2,000 in that bar over the weekend. But him and myself and Dennis Brzozowski and Denny Cedarquist, we were all home at the same time, and we all went to high school together. So we had a pretty good reunion. Fred was the one that I was telling you about. Maybe I didn't tell you about Fred. He got shot over in Vietnam, and then he got shot off the stretcher twice while they were trying to medevac him out.
Wow.
And his father got notified that he was killed in action.
Mm-hmm.
About 2 weeks later, they notified him that he wasn't killed in action. That it, I guess Fred called him from, he finally got to Great Lakes Naval Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And he called his dad and said, no, I'm not dead. And that was a weird situation.
Mm-hmm.
But then they lost his medical records because he was supposed to get a discharge. They lost his medical records, so they kept him in the Marine Corps, and it was really strange.
Mm-hmm.
That's another story. That's a guy you probably should talk to.
Absolutely.
If he'd talk to you.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if he would or not.
Does he talk much about his experiences?
Not too much. Okay. Tom West and myself and Fred were really close friends. Tom West was guy from Illinois that was in Vietnam with Fred.
Mm-hmm.
He could probably tell you all the stories. I mean, he was with Fred the whole time, except for when he got after he got choppered out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Fred was in the hospital and stuff. But prior to that time, Tom was with Fred, and we've stayed together in contact for the last 20 some years.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the transition like for you going from the combat environment to civilian life?
I think that I was probably luckier than a lot of guys. I mean, there was times when you'd be sitting at the stoplight and a car would backfire and you'd dive out of the car just on instinct. But there was another guy in town there. I mean, a car would backfire and he'd be out of the car and underneath the car in a matter of hot second. So, I mean, it affected, guys about the same. I mean, it took a while to acclimate yourself to the fact that nobody was after you. I mean, it takes a while for your instincts to tone down. I mean, you've got these life-preserving instincts that have kept you alive for a little over 13 months, and all of a sudden you're back in an area where they don't matter, but they don't go away. I mean, they stay with you for a long period of time. So different things. But I was a hunter and a fisherman, and I think that kind of stuff helped me out because I'd go hunting. And so I think that kind of stuff really helped tone you down.
Mm-hmm. How long was it after you got back that you became a state trooper?
It'd be about almost 2 years.
Okay. What did you do in that interim?
I was going to college, and I worked in a machine shop at Howmet Corporation in Whitehall. It was aerospace. They built turbine engines for, like, dams, or they built parts for turbine engines for, like, dams and jet engines and stuff like that.
Okay. And you mentioned some of the survival instincts that were preserved over time. How about everyday personal habits that you developed while you were in Vietnam, given the circumstances that you had to undevelop now that you're back in more civilized surroundings? Anything in particular that stands out?
No, I don't. At least in my case, I don't remember being a leader in Vietnam. I guess I was kind of a foregoing person when I came back. I mean, I didn't wait for things to happen. I went forward with my life. I went to college. I took a job, kind of a menial job, but I knew that the classes I was taking at college was going to put me in the machine shop, which is where I wanted to go. And at that time I was also studying architectural engineering and mechanical engineering, so I was looking in the engineering field as a... But I'd always wanted to be a state trooper from even in my youngest days. I guess maybe that's because my dad was a police officer when I was a little boy for a few years. You know, a lot of people I respected, you know, were in law enforcement, like the movies I used to watch when I was a kid, Sky King and The Lone Ranger and Royal Rogers. You know, those guys were all good guys and fighting for justice and all that kind of stuff. So I think having that in my background just kind of led me into the law enforcement field.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a couple years to convince my wife that that's what I should be doing. And I just skipped class one day from college and went down and took the physical fitness test. And, you know, submitted my application, and then I skipped class again to go take the test, and I scored well enough on it to get in.
Okay. Now, did you, as you became a police officer and worked with state troopers, did you find that, you, first of all, did you counter many other veterans, and did you find that your Vietnam experience helped you at all?
There were several situations during my career that involved veterans. And, I think the camaraderie of the Vietnam veterans... I remember one instance, we were going into this biker bar in Muskegon, and this had I'd been in like 11 years, and we were looking for a guy, and I just walked into the bar and walked up to the looked like the head guy of the motorcycle club there, and I says, hey, and I noticed he had a tattoo, he was in the 101st Airborne. I says, Charlie Company 1-4, Quang Tri Province. He says, all right. We started talking. He said, and I, you know, shooting a bull with him. And then I says, hey, I said, I'm looking for this guy. And he says, oh, yeah, he's right over there. So he hollered at the guy and says, hey, Mac, come on over here. These officers want to talk to you. I mean, we didn't have any trouble. We told him that we had a warrant for his arrest, and we went out the door, and, you know, any other guys might have had problems, but we didn't have any problems because I struck up a conversation with the head guy, and we were both veterans and had mutual respect. I had a job to do, and no big deal.
Hmm. How about other veterans as officers, though?
In my recruit school, I'd say that there were probably half a dozen. I think there was 39 in my recruit school when we first started, and I think about half a dozen of us were Vietnam veterans.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, yeah, we kind of kept close together, and we'd talk to each other and try to help the college kids along.
Okay. And what did you think, this is getting close to the end of the war, I guess, when you're first... becoming a police officer, I guess that would have been early 1970s, right? 72?
Yeah, it was really strange that you'd be sitting on in your living room watching television, and you'd see a news broadcast, and I'd say, holy smokes, I said, I just came from there not too long ago, and that
mm-hmm.
was a safe area.
Mm-hmm.
And here these guys are getting blown up driving down this road with their Jeep.
Mm-hmm. What did you think about how the war was winding down, Vietnamization, and then, of course, the Paris Peace Accords in 1973?
Well, I thought that they did the wind down terribly bad. I mean, they left guys hanging out there that shouldn't have been left hanging. They knew that their intelligence was bad there. They had to know. I mean, we knew back in 68, 69 that their intelligence was really bad over there. And just flabbergasted me that they'd have these guys in this area, and they'd presume that it was safe just because it was safe, you know, 2 weeks ago. And you could see by all the newscasts how the North Vietnamese were moving down into the country, and they should have just vacated all those posts instead of just leaving minimal guys there. They should have vacated all those posts and brought them into a bigger post where they had more control. It bothered me quite a bit that they were the way they did things, but in the big scheme of things, the generals and the war planners, they see is a map and a piece of paper. They really don't, they're not there, so they really don't know what's going on. They just know what people are telling them. And I saw a few officers over there had big egos and would stretch the truth, and that wasn't right. I mean, they, just to bolster themselves, to make themselves look better, you know, they'd say that, we had so many ambushes, and so many Vietnamese killed and stuff like that. And in actuality, they only had one that was actually a successful ambush, and they'd claim to have three or four. So things like that that went on during the war really bothered you. And the fact that I got the newspaper from back home, and I'd read what the press was saying about the war, and nobody was telling them the truth.
Was there anything in particular that stood out in your mind as being false and absolutely untrue that you knew, but just was coming out anyway?
Well, just the fact that we weren't going into Cambodia, we weren't going into Laos, we weren't getting our butts whipped. I mean, there's a couple operations. We lost over half our guys, either wounded or killed. And they'd say they were having successful operations and stuff like that. Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think when the war actually ended for the United States with the Paris Peace Accords in January of 1973?
Yeah, I just thought it was about time.
Okay.
About time they got their stuff together, because, I mean, at any given day we could have won that war and taken over North Vietnam. I mean, all they did is pussyfoot around. And, we ran search and clear operations, and all we were really was, like they said, a police action. I mean, all we were doing is trying to protect the South Vietnamese people from the North Vietnamese people, kind of like they did in Korea. And, in the end, they just turned the country over to them, so it didn't really do any real good, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. And how did you think you were treated as a veteran over the years? Both, if you ever had any dealings with the VA, or if you had, just interaction with people in your life, family, friends, acquaintances, coworkers, whatever.
Basically, I had a pretty good relationship with most people. We were like other veterans. I mean, we didn't go around bragging that we were veterans, or if we had a Purple Heart, or we were decorated. I mean, just not something that you bragged about. The people that were close to you knew, but a lot of people didn't have a clue.
Okay.
All they knew is that you were in Vietnam and that you were home and you were alive.
Mm-hmm. And you stayed in and around where you grew up with your family?
For a couple of years till I joined the state police.
Mm-hmm.
Then I spent time all over the state of Michigan.
Okay.
I was, my first post was South Haven, and that was probably 85 miles from my hometown. And then 2 years later I went to Ypsilanti and spent some time in Detroit. And then I went to the UP up in Calumet, up in the Keweenaw Peninsula, and found out what snow was really like.
Okay.
And then in 1981, I got transferred down to Grand Haven, and that's where I spent my last amount of time in the department, and I retired out of there in 95.
Okay. And no matter where you went, the issue of you being a Vietnam veteran was never really all that significant?
No, it wasn't that big a deal.
Okay. No. Do you think the government has taken care of its Vietnam veterans?
Pardon?
Do you think that the United States government has taken care of its Vietnam veterans?
Not as far as I've... I don't think they're taking very good care of any other veterans, but the ones that really need the help, they haven't taken good care of, according to articles that I've read and emails that I've received. But I attribute that basically to having people in the White House that are non-military. They haven't got a clue what it's like, and it seems like veteran stuff just kind of falls through the cracks when you have non-military people in the White House.
Okay. And what do you think, or for you personally, what were the most significant experiences or lessons that you learned about yourself, about life, when you, as a result of serving in Vietnam?
Well, I guess I learned that I have a greater faith in God, and that there is a bigger power out there that kind of directs our lives. It's helped me to be a better person, I think. I've always been a pretty caring person and helpful person, but I think it's kept me on that path as far as me personally helping people out.
Okay. And what lessons do you think we as a nation should take away from the Vietnam War?
Well, I think basically they may have learned the lesson, because what General Schwarzkopf did in the Gulf War was what we should have done in Vietnam. We should have just gone in there with a large amount of people and kicked butt and let them know that we weren't going to tolerate communism or any exploitation of less powerful people. And that's just what they need to do. I mean, they need to take charge. I mean, we are the biggest nation in the world as far as being a superpower, and it's up to us to keep the world safe and let people have a good life. I mean, the stuff that goes on in the Middle East, this religious stuff, they've had this instilled in their people since they were day one, and they keep teaching their kids all this hatred and stuff, and it's not good. I mean, I met a lot of white people and a lot of black people that they teach their kids from the get-go that white people are bad, Spanish people are bad, and, you know, if they're not black, they're bad. And as long as you have these teachings going on, we're never going to get rid of hatred. I mean, a lot of the kids see past it and they know better, but there's still that 10%, 20% that are hardcore anti-this, anti-that, and until we get those people on common ground, we're always going to have conflicts.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
No, not that I can think of. Any questions you have?
I think you pretty much covered the period that we wanted to cover today.
Okay.
So why don't I go ahead and end this officially. Thank you very much. This will end the second interview with Mr. Keith Erdman.